The Guardian.
Football Weekly Extra.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, midweek madness. Man United take foot off gas. Chelsea pull a three-point turn, slip into second, and Arsenal apply the choke. We ask, whatever the result at White Hart Lane, was Spurs-Arsenal simply the game of the season? Meantime, news of the world star. We put a hack on Sid Lowe's line, and it's Sid himself. He's just back from Valencia with a rundown of the Copa del Rey, quite literally, after Sergio Ramos dropped it under their bus. We ask, Team Dubai, is that shark high enough for you, Getafe? Or would you like a bigger one? Get the latest on the state of things in Scotland and look forward to the weekend ahead in the Premier League. All of that and more in Football Weekly Extra. Yeah, hello everyone. And in a convivial and lively pod today, we have Paul Doyle.
Hi.
Hi. Sean Ingle.
Hello.
James, he said apprehensively.
I can't help noticing, James, that you have scratches down your arms.
Yeah, is that what you'll have shortly, Sean Ingle. Sean, an hour late without telling anyone where he'd gone to. Ingle. Tom Lutz.
We've got to hurry because we've got a meeting later, which might take some time.
Nice to see us kicking a bit of old school flavour vis-a-vis our lineup. Lovely. Let's start with the Clasico, Paul. The North London one. 3-3, a thrilling game that gave neither side what they wanted, but it seems it's churlish to criticise, really, after a game that good.
I don't know. I don't know if it's churlish to criticise. Maybe it is. Well, I'm going to criticise anyway, that's okay. It was very exciting, obviously, and there was lots of suspense, and it was action-packed, and it was all very helter-skelter. But I couldn't help being annoyed by some of the errors that were committed throughout, which prevented it from being a really great game.
Which errors did you find most annoying, Paul?
Well, the ones we've come to expect from Arsenal tend to bother after a while. I mean, obviously, there was the goalkeeping error that led to the goal. I mean, Chesney actually thinking he could beat Aaron Lennon in a foot race. The Arsenal's passing at times was quite erratic in the second half, and even more. I mean, their inability to manage a match when they're leading is extraordinary, and their refusal to shoot, for example, on countless occasions.
But Spurs drew as well, and they were at home.
But should we not be celebrating the fact that this was sort of raw, unadulterated sort of classic football? I mean, when Spurs named two forwards up front with Van der Vaart playing behind, it was almost like them taking their shirt off and bearing their moves and saying, come on, what have you got at Arsenal? And I thought it was an absolutely thrilling game. I think it perhaps
What did Arsenal? Did they take anything off or not?
Well, no, but they went for it too. And, you know, and I'm surprised the Arsenal Club Shop haven't released an eight ball with kind of various things you could roll over that says mental fragility, collapsing lead, choke, as something being a quote about, you know, refusing to give in.
That's where he's been for the last hour, Tom, working on that.
No, not at all.
He didn't even look at his notes when he said that. That's on the top of his head.
But Arsenal fans must just wish they showed that much passion against the likes of Sunderland at home, Blackburn at home. And, you know, they've drawn five of the last six Premier League games, and that's why they are, you know, where they are on the table at the moment.
All right. Wango Kid says, just back from the game now, tired, exhilarated and elated. Nobody does derbies like the teams from North London. It wasn't the result we needed or wanted, but both sets of teams and fans should be proud of themselves. Mike Hennessy says, can you not say that's it for Arsenal? Viewing all media today, you'd think we'd lost, not drawn, but they kind of have, though, in the broader scheme of things.
Well, I was watching the game with an Arsenal fan, which was quite funny, and all football fans think that their club is that team, even though all clubs basically have exactly the same ill fortune and good luck. But just watching it last night and seeing Arsenal fold, I looked over and said, actually, I think Arsenal are that team. And this was despite the fact that Wenger did try and address a few issues. I thought last night he beefed up the midfield, so Song and Diaby were in there together, and Wilshere was left on the bench, partly because he's tired, of course. And those two did assert themselves in midfield at the start, but as the game went on, they it was just as Sean said, it was just the same old Arsenal.
Why is it Arsenal folding? Was it not Spurs performing really well and coming back from a game that looked out of their reach at 1.31?
Perhaps. I mean, I think you have to give Spurs credit, and they looked much physically stronger in the second half, and Arsenal wilted, which is unusual for a Wenger side.
Right.
They panicked. Even for Huddleston's goal, the attempt of clearance by the Arsenal player, I think it was Koscielny, I can't remember. But he just rushed his clearance, and with the result that he didn't get a proper connection on it, and he just teed it up for Huddleston. And they gave the ball away. Their decision-making went to pot, which isn't good.
No, although I again have to object to your use of the term teed up. It wasn't like he laid on a glorious assist for Huddleston. It was
a brilliant shot by Huddleston, of course. But if you're thinking straight, you don't tee up Tom Huddleston. He's right. One of the best strikers of the ball in the league. Yeah. Himself and Craig Gardner, maybe, I would suggest.
Oh, interesting.
But we should mention Spurs, who I thought were thrilling in the second half. I thought Modric again had a superb game. Leonard made a difference when he came on. Van der Vaart, the way he cheekily nutmegged Wilshere was
interesting,
very sweet.
Wasn't it?
And I think also we should praise Szczesny because he made a mistake for the penalty, but he kept Arsenal in the game in those last 20 minutes or so.
Yeah, they lost the league, but they have confirmed that they found a keeper.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Szczesny's really got something, and I think he's a good keeper.
All right, well, the build-up to the match lent interest by Cesc Fabregas's candid remarks to Don Ballon magazine, in which he said, basically, Arsenal, we have to decide whether we're going to keep, what's the word he used? Developing players, or actually winning matches. He said a lot of other things as well, but he said basically there's no senior players for the young'uns to look up to, etc., etc., and this model isn't working, I think, effectively. What he said, anything last night to change his opinion, do you think?
Not really, but Arsene Wenger as well, he's 61, and I don't really think by the time you get to that age you change your... I think that's a bit old to be changing your ways, and I know a lot of Arsenal fans are saying we don't need a change of manager, we need our manager to change. That's the phrase that's been going around the last few days, but I just think at his age he's not going to change his philosophy.
The players have let him down to an extent. We can expect some of them to have evolved quicker than they have. Fabregas himself, for example, I mean, I know he's still a young man, but he's very experienced. He's a European champion, a World Cup winner. And although he played very well last night, over the last few weeks generally, he's gone missing. He's sulked. And he if people like Wilshere and other guys are looking up to him, he hasn't been there for them the way, as he says, others were for him in when he first came into the team.
Interesting. They have a trip to Bolton coming up on the weekend, Arsenal. Your thoughts on that? Promising? Bolton, of course, one or two problems of their own after their FA Cup semi-final at the weekend.
Well, it's strange. I mean, Arsenal are actually unbeaten 16 matches in the Premier League. I mean, a lot of those have been draws. You've got to think, you know, Arsenal's title race is run. They're away at Bolton, then at home against Manchester United. But then they've got Stoke, Villa and Fulham. So if they can conjure a result from somewhere, you know, they will perhaps cling on to something. But they haven't got much hope now of winning the Premier League.
No, I think that we can all agree on that last statement. All right. Did Harry at least get his hand shaken by Arsene last night?
I think there wasn't any massive blazing row at the end, was there?
All right, okay. Well, it was a result that went down well in Manchester. The two Manchester teams, rivals of the two North London teams for the top four finishes and titles and other stuff like that. United had kind of reopened briefly the title race, putatively, with that draw at St James's against Newcastle. Looked a little bit jaded, did they, United?
And Newcastle really went at them at the start of the game as well. I think they kind of picked up on that.
Right.
There weren't any kind of clear-cut chances, but Newcastle had loads of pressure at the start.
Right. And Chelsea, meanwhile, moving into second with that big win over Birmingham. The question now would be, well, Sean, the run-in then. If you have a Man United team who are beginning to run out of steam and have an extremely busy month ahead of them, the clash with Everton this weekend, then Schalke, then Arsenal, then another game with Schalke, and then Chelsea...
I mean, to be honest, I think this Saturday's game against Everton at home is crucial because they've got Arsenal and Chelsea after that, then Blackburn and Blackpool. Now, I think they'll beat Blackburn and Blackpool. So really, you figure if they beat Everton, they should win the league, because even if they were to lose against Arsenal and Chelsea, those sides would then have to win every single game and have a better goal difference. And Everton won't be the easiest team to face. They've... looking at it, they've won five of their last seven, and they've only lost two of their last six games against Manchester United.
Really? All right, and a draw, would that be enough to, you know, stick Cat in with the Pigeons?
I think it would, yeah. I think it would get a bit spicy.
All right, then. They had a 3-3 draw back at Goodison Park. Did you already mention that?
No, I didn't, but they did, yeah.
That was one of the games of the season, wasn't it? Another of them. But it was a cracking match. Cracking match, and of course, Everton very much on a roll. Did you know that they're second in the Premier League form table right now. They are.
Chelsea.
Yes, it is Chelsea. Chelsea are top. Do you know who the team in third place is?
West Brom.
Very good, Paul Doyle.
Did you know?
Well, yeah. And in fourth place, it's Man United.
This is a sort of curiosity. I think it's quite an interesting contrast between United's away record on Europe, when they've been fantastic. They've won 12 of their last 14, I think. Mm. And actually, how they've been away in the Premier League, where they seem to draw. And the curious thing is, they're generally more defensive in Europe. And they're generally more, they go for it more in the Premier League, and yet they haven't had the.
Is this what you were doing in the meeting, getting all these stats together? Because they're brilliant.
If on the subject of stats, even if United win their last two away games in the league, they'll still have, and go on to win the league, they'll be the worst ever Premier League champions away from home.
Do you know they've had less away wins this season than Blackpool?
I didn't know that.
Don't you mean you?
That might not be true, but I think it might be true. Yeah. All right. Listen, one other thing before we round off what has been a pretty exceptional part one is this whole Spurs City race for fourth. I mean, that's the title thing. What about the race for fourth? And Spurs, indeed, even petitioning the Premier League this week that they get the Stoke Man City game moved. Why is that, Tom? Why?
Well, I'll tell you. One of the reasons why, and it's fairly obvious, but I was doing a bit of research for the paper on Tuesday, and I was looking at the sums that what it'll be worth for Spurs if they do get into the Champions League. And this season, they'll have made around 36 million quid from the Champions League. If they'd got to the Europa League final, it would have been about 5 million.
You're kidding. So getting all the way to the Europa League final gets you 5 million?
Yeah, and that includes win bonuses. You get more for reaching the group stages of the Champions League than for winning the entire Europa League. So you can see why they're already trying to manipulate or try to avoid manipulation.
So basically, the question here is, and I did a really bad cough syrup played havoc with my explanation on Monday. Brilliant that it was of the whole top four and Europa League thing. But Paul, could you do a better job now?
I'll try. Basically, Redknapp's problem is that it's in Stoke's interests that Man City qualify for the Champions League, because right. then Stoke will qualify for Europe next season.
Just by virtue
just by
of being
in the FA Cup final.
Right. So at the moment, they're scheduled to play Man City after the FA Cup final.
Yeah.
And if they lose, then they'd have about £5 million worth of interest, according to Tom Lutz over here, in getting into the Europa League and thus letting Man City win and go into the top four.
Yeah.
Right,
I'm sure Stoke don't want to get into Europe just for the money. I'm sure the prestige of Stoke being in Europe
right.
Is probably worth even more than that.
Well, indeed.
Or am I being an idealist?
It's a glorious thought. Of course, Tony Pulis has previous with Man City from many years ago. But do you think, I mean, in some countries, there would be... I'm just thinking back, actually, a game whose anniversary is this very week, the Inter's clash with Lazio. Now, last season... Lazio were not that far off the relegation zone. They were playing Inter. Their local rivals and neighbours, Roma, were battling with Inter for the title. And Lazio's ultras actually went to the training ground and also chanted this, just in case anyone had forgotten during the game, that they wanted their team to lose so that Inter would take the title and not Roma. And they basically chanted, you know, if you win, we'll beat you up. There was a giant banner when the Lazio players came out on the pitch saying, move out of the way and let Inter go through. And when Inter scored, eventually they had like this giant banner saying, oh, no. So in some countries, that would be entirely reasonable. Do you think there's any room for that kind of thing? Or is it?
Maybe I'm being naive, but I would be surprised if it happened. Right. I mean, I think partly because Stoke, if they finished two or three places above... you know, say they beat Man City rather than finish two places higher, that can mean the difference between a few hundred thousand pounds, which, you know, we've heard from Tom that the Europa League doesn't actually earn you a lot of money.
Yeah, I just need to clarify something I said about that. The £36 million Spurs make includes TV revenue, so yeah. It'd be about £18 million in prize money, but yeah, it's still way more than get from the Europa League.
All right. Well, fantastic. That's it for part one. We've got loads more on the Premier League weekend to come. Before that, though, in a second or two, we'll be dialing up a man who's had a very exciting week indeed, Sid Lowe. Sid Lowe in Spain.
Hello, James. How are you?
I'm ever so well. Who's that in the background? He asked jealously. Chappers?
Just various randoms walking around in the background.
Oh, where are you, Sid?
I'm in a restaurant.
Oof. It's been a busy week for you.
Yeah, it has.
All right, you were off. I should explain. You were off at the Mestalla. God, it looked glorious last night, didn't it? You know, with that.
It was fantastically good fun. The atmosphere was brilliant. It was a great occasion, and I'm happy to say as well, an occasion that didn't turn nasty. And I must say, given the way that things have been built up over the last 6 months or so, maybe even longer, I wasn't entirely sure that was going to happen. So that was really, really good. And it turned out to be quite an exciting game as well.
When you say nasty, do you mean what, on the pitch or between the fans off it?
Well, no, between the fans. Because of the way it's been cranked up by the media, because of the extent of almost the obligation to hate each other that exists between the two clubs now, which is, say, cranked up by an extremely partisan media where there's a kind of sense of moral high ground taken by both sides and false sensibility, and it's always edgy. It's always felt a little bit like something could be about to happen, and that's why it was so pleasing that really and truly it didn't last night. At least as far as I know, it didn't.
All right. Well, tell us about the atmosphere at the ground, and then back in Madrid for the extraordinary and brilliantly successful open top bus tour of 4 a.m.
Brilliant from Sergio Ramos. So Sergio Ramos is on the top deck of the open top bus with the Copa del Rey in hand. He drops this. Now, of course, he drops it down the front of the bus at the time that the bus is moving. So the bus runs over the Copa del Rey.
It drives.
They've not won a trophy for, I think I'm right in saying, 3 years, Real Madrid. They get one and they go and squash it under a bus.
And then the bus just continues oblivious for what, sort of a minute or so before?
Didn't entirely realise. No, yeah. This thing sort of rolls under the front. And Sergio Ramos, in talking to, I think it was Tele Madrid or one of the TV channels anyway, said, oh, no, it's all right, the cup's fine. I was thinking, that dent doesn't look very fine to
me. Have you seen the cup? Because it was wedged under the bumper for, I don't know, several hundred yards. What's it look like now?
Well, I haven't seen it up close, but it's certainly got a fair few scratches and a couple of dents in it, yeah.
That's shocking. That really is shocking. But anyway, huge party atmosphere there on the way to the Cibeles and people jumping up and down and hanging scarves over the fountain and all that. The usual business and lots of triumphant headlines about Mourinho. Was it his triumph, Sid? Was it? Is that what the papers are saying?
Yes, it was. One of the headlines on AS, I think, says Mourinho did it. And I think it's very much seen as his triumph, because not just because of the fact that Madrid have finally won something and it's he that's the manager that's doing it, but because of the nature of the way that they did it. But this is seen as you know, a tactical success as much as anything else. And as I was saying the other day, in many ways, I don't think Mourinho is a tactical genius, in that I don't think what he does tactically is especially revolutionary or especially clever. What is so very, very impressive about it is the ability to make players follow him to the absolute letter, to really work very, very hard at following every little detail. What Mourinho really is fantastically meticulous rather than necessarily inventive. And Real Madrid, again, were fantastic in the meticulous details, right down to things with, like, the, and I know it sounds a bit unpleasant to say this, but things like the speed with which they surrounded the referee and put pressure on him, the speed with which they made challenges early in the game, the very interesting development of Pepe as this kind of deep line midfielder who's not a deep line midfielder at all. He's almost like an aggressive defensive midfielder, but from the front of the midfield, kind of going out on raids and cutting people down. And Madrid, I thought, were the better side in the first half, created far more chances than Barcelona. Then, I must say, I thought Barcelona had a really, really good 35 minutes or so in the second half, where I thought they played exceptionally well, but Casillas made three or four good saves. And then it sort of slowed a little. And, of course, Madrid got the goal in extra time. So it was one of those where you'd say it was a game of two halves, only, of course, a four half.
Yeah, indeed. Barcelona, best team in the world and all that, but should they now be worrying a little bit ahead of the Champions League semis?
Should. Yeah, of course they should. And I think they should, because not only did Real Madrid, I wouldn't go so far as to say did Real Madrid found them out, because bear in mind that we're talking about a game, we're talking about a very, very strong Real Madrid side, we're talking about the amount of money it costs to build the Real Madrid side, and we're talking about a very defensive approach where in the Champions League it may be slightly different, because of course it's two games, and Barcelona will feel that playing one of them at home gives them an advantage that perhaps they didn't have this time around. But I think they'll be worried because there are certain things that aren't quite working for Barcelona. Villa's gone 11 games without a goal. Pedro isn't looking quite right. Leo Messi is getting more and more involved and is still a fantastically brilliant player, but is getting deeper and deeper all the time. And I think to the extent that it's becoming counterproductive on occasions. And then you look at the thing that we've talked about quite a lot this season, but we haven't really felt until now, and that is the strength of the squad. Last night, Real Madrid started with Higuain, Benzema, Adebayor, and Kaká on the bench. Barcelona just simply cannot compete with that. And over the course of four games, that may well become a really big factor.
Sid, bearing in mind what you just said, is Guardiola coming under any criticism at all for failing to rest the squad? For example, in the second leg against Shakhtar, I was surprised that despite being 5-1 up, they fielded a full-strength team.
I think not so much criticised for failing to rest as criticised for maybe not having a squad with which he feels he can rest. But yeah, there's been one or two question marks, but bear in mind that Guardiola is virtually untouchable in Catalonia. And even some of the things that he clearly does get wrong, people don't really level at him, people don't really criticise him for. But that's certainly one of the things that's sort of floating in the air, the idea of should we have rotated more, should we have had a bigger squad, should we have created a situation in which we could go into three competitions and genuinely think we can get away with it.
Well, there you go. That's Barcelona and no doubt Shakira, that Yoko Ono effect. That we could discuss that if we had further time. Sid, very interesting. Meantime, the other big story in Spain this week, Getafe Team Dubai.
Yeah. I don't even know where to start except just to say, isn't it just awful?
All right, what's the story in broad brushstrokes?
Basically, new investors who are going to take over a Spanish club. There were rumours about it being Zaragoza. It turns out it's Getafe. They're going to buy out Getafe. They've already registered a new logo for Getafe, which has the current Getafe thing, but at the bottom of the bag it says Team Dubai. They've registered a website, which I think I'm right in saying www.getafeteamdubai.com or more or less something like that. And all of this, of course, is prompting people to say, hang on, does this mean, well, I think it does mean that they're going to try and change the name of Getafe to Team Dubai. So one of the teams in the Spanish league could be Team Dubai. And Getafe, to some extent, are a slightly artificial club anyway, in that they're a club with a very limited history. I think they've only been around for 34 years, in the first division for 4 or 5 years. But they've been trying to build that identity and trying to build that relationship with fans. And of course, I think it's probably all going to go to pot now.
Why are they trying to do this?
Why are the investors trying to do this, or the club?
Yeah, no, why is the club... Well, the club have got big debts, so they're paying off their debts.
Well, the club are trying to do it for a very simple reason, which, yes, exactly, is an owner who's got big debts, and he quite fancies the idea of getting his hands on however many millions of euros it is. I think the figure I saw was 90 million euros, but it's hard to believe that it's quite that big.
Right, OK. But isn't this exactly the kind of massive, arbitrary financial superpowering that the UEFA restrictions, which come in shortly, are designed to limit? So are they not late to the party with this one?
Possibly, but you try telling that to the investors themselves who believe that, for whatever reason, believe that they can get something out of this, believe they can make it worthwhile. I can only assume that they're not entirely stupid and they've looked into that and that they recognise that there's a way around it.
All right, OK. And what's the reaction been among Getafe fans and the Spanish press?
Well, first and foremost, Getafe fans, what Getafe fans? Sorry to say they have pretty much the smallest fan base in the first division. As I say, because there isn't that history, there isn't that identity. It's a Southern Madrid club, so most of their fans are or were Real Madrid or Atletico Madrid fans anyway. So there hasn't been huge backlash yet. But I think over the next few days there will be. It'll be very interesting to see what the reaction is like over the weekend when they play their first game since all this was broken. And then the reaction in the whole of Spain, well, this has been Copa del Rey Clásico week, so it's been a story that people have talked about and people have said this is ridiculous and how can we let this happen, but it hasn't yet had that huge impact that you might have expected. I honestly think it will do when it goes through, and if and when we're confirmed that even the name will change.
Hey, bit of a shake-up in the Liga then, literally, Tom Lutz. And in Ligue 1, what's happening there?
It's very exciting, James. The title race looks like going down to the wire with Lille, who were, I think they were up to maybe 6 points clear a few weeks ago. The gap at the top now is down to 1 point. Marseille are breathing down their neck. Marseille, of course, have the benefit of experience, having won the title last year. And without playing well almost at any point this season, they continue to grind out results. And Lille have hit a small wobble, and they're starting to concede goals where they hadn't conceded that many before, and not quite scoring as many as before. I think all the neutrals would love to see Lille win, not just because they're the underdogs and they haven't won anything for over 50 years, but because they play unusually in Liga, very exciting, enterprising, attacking football.
Do you think they're going to hang on then?
I hope so. They had a good morale boosting win during the week to reach the cup final.
So they're in the cup final as well.
Yeah, so I mean they could do the double. They also in that match though in the semi final win they lost Florent Balmont, who isn't one of their most exciting players. He's the sort of workhorse in midfield, but he plays a very important role there, and he's going to be out for a few weeks. And they have probably got a slightly tougher run in than Marseille, even though Marseille in a few weeks do have to play Lyon in a match that will be huge, because Lyon still have an outside chance of winning the title, but most of all they're desperate to qualify for the Champions League, because it would be a disaster for them to miss out. But other than that match against Lyon, Marseille's run-in is quite comfortable.
Can we talk a little bit about Lyon? Because I know they threw a two-goal lead a couple of weeks ago, and Hugo Lloris was fuming with their players. Then Lille stuttering last couple of games seemed to have given them another chance, but then they lost to PSG at the weekend. What's gone wrong there?
Lyon haven't been playing well all season. I mean, the big cause célèbre is Johan Gourcuff, who was supposed to be the playmaker which would replace Juninho, for example. He hasn't played well all season. He was taken off at the weekend, in fact, which is a sign of Claude Puel, who has been protecting him and singing his praises all year and saying he'll come good, has perhaps finally lost faith. And Lloris himself, who I know is continually linked with a move to England, one of the reasons why I don't think he should be rated quite as highly as he is, although he is slightly weak on crosses. It's an area of the game he has to improve, and he was flapping at a cross that gave PSG the winning goal at the weekend. He's an absolutely brilliant shot stopper, very good in one-on-one situations, but he needs to work on that aspect of his game. And the other thing is defensively, Lyon haven't replaced Chris, who's the last surviving member of the all-conquering team, which won 7 in a row, and he's still creeping on, but his performances have waned, and they desperately need a new centre-back. But I suspect that will be a problem that a new manager will have to deal with in the summer. And in fact, they'll bring someone up from the youth ranks, because that's their what they're intending to do for next season. They're not going to be splashing out.
Right. Lille, in the meantime, do they have a lot of money behind them?
No, not a huge amount.
What would be a comparable club in the Premier League
to Lille?
Yeah,
I mean they were very big in the '50s. They were quite dominant for a while in the '50s, but since then, they've done nothing. Claude Puel, who, as I just mentioned, is the Lyon manager, sort of made his name as a manager at Lille because, almost like David Moyes at Everton, he had them punching above their perceived weight. They do have a little bit of money because finally they're moving into a new stadium next season. So if they can keep this team together and get into the Champions League, which they certainly should qualify for the Champions League, then they will start perhaps become a force on a sustainable basis.
All right. One of two exciting players that they talk about a lot, Eden Hazard, of course, and that man Sal.
Yeah, their front three, Moussa Sow, the Senegalese centre-forward, Gervinho, the Ivorian winger who plays on the left and who Liverpool are looking at very closely and who they'll probably go for if they don't get Ashley Young in the summer, and Eden Hazard, yeah, who Arsenal are
Eden
big
Hazard,
wires.
I think you've
might have Sorry,
yeah.
I've mispronounced
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Okay, excellent. Very good, very good. Well, moving along, Scotland. Less happy tidings there with the incendiary bomb sent to the Celtic Magic. It's extraordinary. Not quite sure even where to begin with this one. The situation after the last Old Firm game, of course, the two sides are facing off again this weekend. Celtic, 1 point now, is it, behind Rangers at the top of the SPL, and there was extraordinary decision not to ban not to hand out punishments, I think, am I right in saying, for any of the Rangers personnel involved in the fracas after the last Old Firm game. And now you've got incendiary devices sent to four people, including Celtic manager Neil Lennon. Just extraordinary how things have got polarised up there, and Lord knows how this weekend's going to go. One can only hope for the best.
Well, I think it's always been polarised. But I think also we should flag up that Ali McCoist has come out and criticised sectarian chanting, which I think managers on both sides of the divide have been loath to do in the past.
El Hadj Diouf as well. There was accusations from Rangers fans that Lennon had racially abused him back in that cup tie in March, and of all the people in the world to be a peacemaker, El Hadj Diouf came forward and said, look, no, there was no racial element to it. So the players and the staff are trying to calm it down on both sides, but
right.
That doesn't seem to be helping.
Extraordinary.
El Hadj Diouf, of course, is a friend of Colonel Gaddafi.
Is he?
Yeah, he was mentioned earlier this week that he didn't really know what was going on in Libya, but he said, Gaddafi's a good friend of mine.
He likes his management style.
Right. Interesting. Morton, this is also interesting, posts in to say, Yari, the King Litmanen, signed a playing contract with his old club, HJK Helsinki, which I imagine you pronounce quite differently, this week. The guy's 40 years old, and the best bit, we're going to see him in the Champions League in autumn, because Helsinki are presumably in the qualifiers. Will he add to the 23 goals he already has in the tournament? That's quite a thought, isn't it?
He's a fantastic player. I think he perhaps wasn't completely appreciated by most English fans because he had his best period with Ajax, obviously, and then when he joined Liverpool, he wasn't perhaps played as much as he should have been, and also he was perhaps slightly past his best, but a wonderful player in his prime.
Yeah, he wasn't appreciated by Gerard Houllier, who knew he was a good player but couldn't quite bring himself to play such a free spirit on a regular basis.
Gerard Houllier, of course, today has been taken to hospital. We'll talk more about that in a second. Tangerine Peter FY8 says, very surprised to hear the pod's take on Ian Holloway's comments post the Wigan match. We kind of asked what he was... You remember his post-match comment? He said that, we need the team to be together and fight, and we haven't had that since January. I wonder why. And the way this was picked up on TV was that it was a kind of thinly veiled dig at Charlie Adam not playing to his full potential after not getting a transfer. Tangerine PFY8 says, I suspect the vast majority of Blackpool fans would assume it was a very direct dig at Ollie not being properly backed by Chairman Carl Oyston in the January transfer window. When all other lower place clubs seek to strengthen their squads, he was denied all his preferences as unable to compete on wages, etc., and had to bring in last resorts. Tangerine Peter FY8 then goes on to say, as the Oyston family saved Blackpool back in the 80s buying it for a song, seems they feel fully justified in taking back the return on their investment by retaining £90 million worth of Sky Premier League money while only putting into the team, squad, ground and training facilities the minimum they can get away with. And he suggests, should Sky introduce a little clause in their contract so that promoted teams actually strengthen their playing squad with money? After all, that's what they're given it for, to increase the entertainment value of their product. You can't really fault Blackpool for their entertainment value this year, although possibly that is more to do with Ian Holloway's style than Carl Oyston's deep pockets. But interesting that, I thought.
Yeah, it's a little bit. I mean, Blackpool have only won once since 12th of January, I think, yeah. And they've lost 10 of their last 13. So. Yes. Yeah, really not going well at the moment.
Not going well. Well, in a second or two, we're going to look at their chances this very weekend when they're taking on Newcastle and the rest of the Premier League fixtures. All right, producer Ben's just been on the magical internet device and discovered that Yari Litmanen signed for Fulham in 2008 and never played a single game. Extraordinary, that, isn't it? Now, this weekend, Man United take on Everton. I think we discussed that before. Aston Villa are up against Stoke with poor old Gerard Houllier in hospital. Looks like, I'm not sure if he'll have to stay there. They say he's under observation for a few days, and Gary McAllister will be in charge as they take on a Stoke team that's presumably on a massive high after that whopping win against Bolton.
That'll probably be a great match to watch because obviously since their emphatic semi-final win at the weekend, people are finally starting to give Stoke the credit they deserve, particularly their wing play, Pennant and Etherington. And I saw Villa last weekend at West Ham, and they were brilliant, particularly out wide with Downing and Young and the two fullbacks providing support, and Darren Bent, who is excellent and I dare say the best striker and best English striker in England, but so that should be a very entertaining game.
All right, excellent. Now we've mentioned Spurs' appeal to the FA about Stoke, so let's move on to Blackpool Newcastle. How many games is it? They haven't won in six, Blackpool. Yes.
Yeah, they've lost 10 of the last 13, which is clearly worrying. They're huge odds on favourites now
to go down. Well, they've gone into the bottom three. However, could this be the game in which they turn things around? They did beat Newcastle 2-0 at St James's earlier in the season.
Possibly. I mean, I think Newcastle are quite tidy. They played very well against Manchester United. They don't really offer much up front. And I think if Blackpool are going to get out of it, looking at their running, they do have to win, I think, on the weekend.
Hmm. Tom?
Well, I think the poster touched on... I've forgotten his name, sorry. Apologies.
Tangerine Pete, FYA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tangerine Pete. And it is just the size of their squad. And it's if you don't strengthen that over January, then the players who are already limited experience at that level anyway are just going to tire. And that's what is happening to Blackpool. I think Ian Holloway actually said that at the beginning of the season as well. He said it's not now, it's kind of later on.
All right.
That's when our real season starts.
And also, I think Charlie Adam isn't played as well the second half of the season. He has, you know, a lot of misplaced passes last week, and that's obviously, you know, affecting them.
Yeah, all right. And Newcastle, of course, coming off that 0-0 draw with Man United. Liverpool are taking on your mob, Tom. Birmingham, are they safe now? Do we decide they need one more win?
Yeah.
All right.
One more win, and there's I think against Chelsea, actually, I think that was our game in hand, but we were never going to win that, and there was almost a sense that we were just trying to preserve a few bodies for that game and then concentrate on games like Wolves, which will probably decide. But I think Birmingham will probably stay up just because there's plenty of teams around them that aren't in form.
Just very briefly to flag up, I think a lot of people have talked about Suarez and talked about Coit and talked about Andy Carroll. But I think I'm right in saying that under Dalglish, Liverpool have kept nine clean sheets out of the 17 games they've played. So I think that's quite interesting how he's also, you know, kept them much more defensively tight.
How is Jamie Carragher? Does anybody know?
Well, he gave an interview after the match in which he said it was just a flesh wound and he's fine.
Right,
in fact,
okay.
It wasn't even a flesh wound, was it?
No. But yeah. He did slump to the ground like a granny thrown from a North Sea liner or whatever. Anyway, hope she's well as well. Spurs taking on West Brom. Yeah, interesting. Wolves, that's a big game, at home to Fulham. Won't necessarily be the most attractive fixture of the weekend, but it is a big game, as is Sunderland's clash with Wigan. Sunderland haven't won in 9 games now.
Well, I think Sunderland have come under a lot of criticism since Bent's gone, that the goals have gone, but I was looking at their results over the last few months, and they've only actually kept one clean sheet since January, so that's a completely different problem. And the only point they've picked up since January has been against Arsenal, which
tells its own story.
On earlier.
Yeah. Wigan, meantime, have moved out of the bottom three following their victory over Blackpool at the weekend. But it's a huge game. Sunderland not really in the relegation battle yet.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, there's a huge myth, I think, that everyone expects teams that are down the bottom at sort of from March onwards, they start picking up because they have to. And actually, in effect, that hasn't been the case. I mean, we've talked about Blackpool only won once since mid-January. Blackburn haven't won since the end of January. Sunderland have lost 8 out of 9. Wolves have lost their last 2 by 3 goals. It's quite hard. I mean, none of them really are kind of pushing on out of it. They're all sort of happy to wallow in the mire like some, you know, I don't know, some goth
Sunderland and Blackburn weren't wallowing in the mire. It's not that they haven't pushed on, it's that they've plummeted. Yeah. Wolves.
I'm just trying to remember Wallow in the Mire. What's
it's
that?
It's a Doors song.
Doors song.
Oh, yeah. Right, yeah. Something about a funeral pyre, I think.
Oh, yeah. Light My Fire. Yeah. Gotcha.
So, what was the original question? Because I could follow up.
I was asking which Doors song it came from.
Yeah, no. The original.
You were saying about teams at the bottom.
Yeah, which match were you talking about?
Wigan.
Yes, listeners, it's come to this.
Wigan are at least showing, despite, you know, their limited ability, like they won last week, and I don't think it's unreasonable for them to expect them to think they could perhaps beat Sunderland here.
A lot depends on Hugo Rodrigo, because they've got a lot of creative talents in their team. McCarthy and Zogbia, that other guy whose name I can't remember. Cleverly, that's it.
Yeah. Tom Cleverly.
But Rodrigo hasn't been putting the chances away with any great regularity.
But it's interesting, if you look at the form or table, their record away from home puts them in the top half.
Wigan?
Of the Premier League table, yeah.
Yeah, well, there you go. Hey, that's the clash at the stadium. We like the other game, Chelsea-West Ham, which we might have touched on only briefly to start off with, but just to say that Chelsea have to win really all their remaining games for this notional thin chance of the title to have any
West Ham are a really hard team to predict, because when they win, as they did a little bit over January and February, they win really convincingly. But when they lose very, very convincingly. They were an absolute shambles
last
week.
Well, you saw the game last weekend. This is the thing. They went through this mini revival, and everyone was raving about Hitzlsperger coming back from injury and how Demba Ba had turned things around up front. And now they haven't won a game in five, and they're back in the bottom three. What was the difference?
As I said...
Was it Avram Grant getting sent to the stands?
I don't know. They were a completely incoherent team last year. Injuries have afflicted them badly all season, and in that game against Villa at the weekend, they lost two players mid-match. Hitzlsperger, who did play really well after coming back from injury, has had a dip in form, and so there's nothing in midfield. Victor Obinna, who at times can look brilliant, I didn't even know what position he was playing last week. He contributed absolutely nothing, and most of the players, in fact, played badly. The only ones who emerged with any credit were Rob Green, who was responsible for the score not being about 8-1, and Robbie Keane did all right, but they couldn't get the ball to him with any great regularity.
Scott Parker?
Well, Scott Parker's injured as well, course. I forgot to mention that. He's the glue and the engine in that team. And he don't know when he will be back. It could be this weekend. It might not be for another 3 weeks.
They're missing their glue engine. Sean?
Well, no, West Ham's record against teams in the top half the table in the way is shocking. I wouldn't be surprised if they're thrashed again.
Thrashed again. My word. That's it then for today's Football Weekly Extra. We're back on Monday with our roundup of all the exciting events of the weekend. And who knows, in this crazy, crazy season, what surprises await us over the next few days. Do join us then on Monday. Many thanks to Sean Ingle, to Tom Lutz and Paul Doyle and producer Ben in the meantime. And if you're excited by European headlines and that kind of thing, there will be the usual Friday roundup. I think up a little bit earlier. I think the plan is to get it up maybe even on Thursday evening, because a lot of people are off on Friday. One other a little bit of business. Producer Ben insists that our Football Weekly live thing on the Champions League night is sold out, and yet not, because 100 extra tickets have now been added. Not sure where, if we're just kind of... But anyway, apparently there are extra 100 tickets going out, plus the two that are going to be for auction at St. Joseph's Maid of Ale. So, very, very exciting. We'll speak to you on Monday. Have a lovely weekend. Bye-bye for now.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.